And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you are with us. Election Day is 2 weeks from today. Early voting begins Thursday, and this afternoon, a conversation about the race to become the next mayor of Baltimore. Most people don't think it's much of a race. The winner of the Democratic primary has won the general election every time since Theodore McKeldin was first elected in 1943. But the ballot for Baltimore mayor does include a Democrat, a Republican, and a Green Party candidate, as well as at least five people who have registered as write-in candidates. 7 weeks ago, I invited Senator Catherine Pugh, the Democratic nominee, Alan Walden, the Republican nominee, and Joshua Harris, the nominee of the Green Party, to appear together on today's show. All three candidates accepted our invitation immediately. 5 days ago, Senator Pugh's campaign spokesperson, Gary Brown, informed me that Senator Pugh would not be available to be on today's program. That evening, and again on Saturday and Sunday, I asked Mr. Brown for an explanation. On Sunday morning, after repeated requests, he did call me, but he declined to elaborate as to why Senator Pugh had changed her mind. The senator, of course, has every right to change her mind. I'm just sorry that I can't explain to you the reasons behind that decision. I'll note that last April, before the primary election, Senator Pugh also canceled her appearance a day or two before she was scheduled to be on the morning show that I was hosting at the time. And on the day of that broadcast, the senator walked into the studio 15 minutes after the show had started. So she did ultimately keep that commitment. Alan Walden and Joshua Harris are here this afternoon. And yesterday, when I invited former Mayor Sheila Dixon to join us, she also accepted our invitation right away. Ms. Dixon came in second in a crowded Democratic primary field, losing to Senator Pugh by about 2 points or 2,400 votes last April. She is one of several people who have registered as a write-in candidate. The former mayor is 62 years old. She lives in Hunting Ridge on the city's west side. Ms. Dixon is currently working with the Maryland Minority Contractors Association. She was first elected to the city council in 1987. She served as the mayor of Baltimore from 2007 until 2010, until she resigned following a misdemeanor conviction for misappropriation of gift cards given to her by some real estate developers. Republican nominee Alan Walden is 80 years old. He was a morning anchor and commentator at WBAL radio for 16 years. And for years before that, he was a chief radio correspondent for NBC News Worldwide. He lives in Baltimore's Cross Keys with his wife, Jeannie. Green Party candidate Joshua Harris is 30 years old and lives in the Hollins Market area of Southwest Baltimore. He's a community activist and a co-founder of Hollins Creative Placemaking. He's also a former legislative aide for Delegate Charles Sidner, who represents parts of Baltimore County. A Chicago native and a graduate of Augsburg College in Minneapolis, Mr. Harris moved to Baltimore in 2012. We'd love to have you be part of our conversation for the hour. You can give us a call at 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wypr.org, or you can send us a tweet. Our handle is @MiddayTomHall. Welcome to you all. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
So, Ms. Dixon, let's start with you. You've been a lifelong Democrat. You've been in a lot of primaries, a lot of elections. You were the first person to announce your intention to run for mayor before the primaries, before the primary election last April. The fact that you've decided to mount a write-in campaign, what does that say about your respect for the primary process and the electoral process that we've seen in place for many, many years?
Well, first of all, actually, when I registered to vote when I was at Northwestern High School, I was independent. And it was over that period of time, and actually, I probably am more independent than anything, to be honest with you. But, you know, after the primary election, and I won 9 out of 14 districts, but I also saw what took place during that process. This is the first time in the history of the state of Maryland that an election was decertified. And it was decertified because there were questions for 71 precincts. There were provisional ballots that were thrown out. They judges allowed independent voters to vote during their primary. And unfortunately, you know, those were thrown out. So there are a whole host of questions. So, you know, of course, I'm not a sore loser. I'm not, you know,
sad. Excuse me. Those questions were settled because
the
election
really
was recertified.
Yeah, but they really weren't settled.
Not accept the findings of the recertification?
Oh, of course. And if I had $1 million to have launched to have taken this to court and through the judicial process, it would have happened. But it really wasn't settled. The state really literally threw up their hands because it was such a total mess. Instead of them saying, let's fix this, let's figure out what happened, they threw their hands up and said, you know what? We can't answer these questions. We're just going to move forward and hope that this doesn't happen. Well, but that's what happened. But aside from,
I think there are other people who would disagree with that.
Okay, people can disagree. But the other fact is, I ran into so many people, and these are people I don't know. I don't know them personally, but I ran into so many people this summer who were discouraged about what happened because people were pushing people to vote, to register to vote. And I had so many people say that they weren't even going to vote in this general election. I said, no, you don't want to do that. You want this process to work. They felt that their vote did not count. I also felt that people's vote didn't count. I had people that approach me and say they were going to write me in, and these are people I didn't know. And I said, well, hold it. Let me find out what the process is. I mean, I even had a conversation with Joshua Harris that I was considering that. And once I found out that it won't count unless I file, and the fact that we're in a crisis in this city. You know, to be able to accept 300 murders as a norm moving forward is unacceptable. We have a dysfunctional city government, and I don't care what people are saying. Every day that I talk to people, and believe me, because people know who I am, you know, they stop me on the street. Their services are not being rendered. The taxes that they're paying, I mean, there are a whole host of issues.
But excuse me, let me go back to this notion that people don't feel that their vote counts. There's one thing for a person to feel, to have the gut, you know, visceral reaction that their vote doesn't count. There's another thing to say that their vote actually doesn't count. And the Board of Elections has said that those votes do count and that they counted the votes and that you came up about 2,400 votes short.
I understand that, but they also threw out
provisional ballots,
close to 3,000. I also found out, and this is where, and this might be something as relates to Baltimore, when they had individuals from other counties to come and do the count, I got a couple calls from people who said that there were boxes of ballots with Bernie Sanders' name on it, with my name on it, that were in a box, and they asked, are we going to count these?
Okay, but all this would have been part of a court proceeding, but the court proceeding wasn't able to take place.
I mean, I couldn't afford to do that. And then there was a group who did file.
And if the margin had been smaller, the onus of paying for a recount or paying for an investigation would not have fallen
Well,
to you.
But even with a recount, it would have only been using the ballots that the state counted. So it would have taken a lawsuit to have gone and dug further.
Well, let me move to a couple of folks, the other folks on the table. Mr. Walden, what do you think this does, the fact that a person as prominent and well-known as Ms. Dixon is now mounting a really rigorous and vigorous writing campaign? What does that do for your chances?
Well, I don't know what it does. It could do one of two things. A, it could split the vote between Ms. Dixon and Senator Pugh, or it could simply invite more people to the polls to vote for Democrats. There are any number of possibilities here. I welcome Sheila Dixon to the fray. We've known one another a long time. We get along pretty well, even though we disagree on many things. I want to make a point here, though. I promised, because I was literally had smoke coming out of my ears earlier when I heard from your producer that Catherine Pugh had decided not to appear on this program. The duck and cover period should end sometime soon. As far as I'm concerned, her unwillingness to appear on this program and her unwillingness to appear on other programs with other anchors on other stations smacks of the worst kind of political arrogance. And the arrogance is based on the premise, with some validity, that if you win the Democratic primary, you have won the election in Baltimore. And I run into this in a very odd way, and I did this past weekend, when I approached some people when I was out and about, actually at the farmers market under the JFX, and I asked people about the election and what they planned to do and introduced myself, and we talked for a while, and more than one said to me, I thought we already voted. I said, no. That was the primary election back in April. And one of them said to me, you mean we have to vote again? there are some people out there who
voter education always an important thing every election.
That's it. Again, and there are people out there who do not understand the process, and this, I believe, is encouraged. I'm not saying it's encouraged overtly, but it is encouraged by Catherine Pugh's disappearance. Fly under the radar, assume that you've won, and don't bother with anything
else.
And
again, we do not know whether the reasons that the senator is not here have to do with scheduling or personal reasons. We don't know. I mean,
I understand
anything.
That.
So I can't speak to that.
But you mentioned more than one telephone conversation. Well, you mentioned more than one call. And you did say you had a conversation in which no explanation was given. It's not the first time it's happened.
Josh Harris, there have been, to my count, just one mayoral forum since the primary. Mm-hmm. Am I counting right? I mean, during the mayoral primary season, I mean, Ms. Dixon, you can remind me, was 60 it 60-something? You know,
yeah.
I mean, so there were more mayoral forums than, you know, you can shake a stick at. Mm-hmm. Has that been a frustration to you that you haven't been able to get in front of the voters with the other two candidates who are on the ballot?
I think that it helps to bring awareness to what voters' options are in this election. But I also like to, I guess, express my agreeance with Ms. Dixon. I've knocked on 8,000 doors personally since the primary. And in that, there have been so many people I found who were discouraged because of what happened in the primary, the provisional ballots that weren't counted, and they were literally feeling like they didn't want to vote because why do it? And in that, I've even run into people who were paid to vote. Who have told me personally that they were given money to show up and to volunteer and to go in and vote for someone on election day.
And again, we got to mention that that's an uncorroborated assertion, but, you know, if that's what people are telling you.
These are people who probably told him and me different times the same thing, that they got paid to go in and vote.
A lot of this is anecdotal, but it was brought up to
all
me.
All of it's anecdotal.
Okay, let's say all of it is anecdotal, but it was brought up to me by workers for the Republican Party, because I'm the Republican nominee, that back during the primary, there were people who were actually at the polling places saying, don't vote for this guy. He's a Republican. He's not one of us. You shouldn't vote for him. It was illegal, immoral, or even fattening. But anecdotally, it happened.
And I think we have to remember that the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence. So just because we don't have direct connection to it doesn't mean that it didn't happen. But again, back to my campaign, it has been it's been a bit frustrating to not be able to have the attention or the voters in the masses. But you know what we've been doing? We've been going directly to voters. We've knocked on thousands of doors, and Harris for Mayor signs are going up all over the city, and we've galvanized an entire new base of support and people who are excited to have an option this November, because usually in the primary, there hasn't been an option in the past. And so people are just excited to see that they have a candidate that wants to work for them, not for BG&E, not for Under Armour, but for the people of Baltimore. And that's the message we've been delivering to voters directly to their doorsteps every single day.
All right. We will have more on the mayor's race with Sheila Dixon, Alan Walden, and Joshua Harris. You can join our conversation here on Midday, 410-662-8780. That's our phone number, 410-662-8780. You can drop us a tweet at Midday Tom Hall or send us an email, midday@wipr.org. It is Midday. I am, in fact, Tom Hall. At least I was the last time I checked. And we will all be right back after this quick break. Midday Indeed continues. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us today. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, more on politics in this very busy political season. We'll talk to Republican candidate for Congress, Dr. Mark Plaster. He's running against incumbent John Sarbanes in Maryland's 3rd Congressional District. That's the Wednesday edition of Midday. If you're just joining us today, we're talking with mayoral candidates Republican Alan Walden, Green Party nominee Joshua Harris, and write-in candidate Democrat Sheila Dixon. We'd love to hear from you. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And you can send us a tweet. Our handle is @midday. Tom Hall. Let's talk about a couple of issues, then we will go to the phones. Ms. Dixon, Marilyn Mosby, the state's attorney, has issued just recently a rather comprehensive proposal for police reform, having to do with changing the special investigative response teams, having to do with the makeup of people on the trial boards, increasing accountability to the local communities by even suggesting that officers, for example, the ones who were charged in the death of Freddie Gray, not be allowed a judge trial, be obliged to take a jury trial. What do you think of her proposals, and what's your response?
Some of the changes that she wants to make, particularly with the transparency of increasing and making sure the community is involved in the trial board, some of the areas I have a concern because I just recently read about it, about some of the changes that she wants to make. And I think what has to happen, and this is where if we don't come together and deal with the Department of Justice and the MOU and have the state's attorney, as well as the mayor's office, as well as groups like No Boundaries and other groups that are out here putting proposals together, really, really come together and look comprehensively. We don't need to create separate entities to try to control and deal with the police department. And what I'm sensing from what she's trying to do is to create something separate and above than working with the administration, working with the police department and the community together. So those are my general thoughts.
So the current structures allow the potential and the capacity to fix what's
well,
broken.
No, I'm not saying that the current structure allows to fix everything, because it doesn't. There are changes that has to happen. But what we don't want to do is then create these little islands in the city where you have this group is making these kind of demands and this group making these kind of demands based on the state's attorneys, the police department, and advocacy groups. We got to have something comprehensive. Yes, we have to have more transparency. Yes, we have to have communities who are part of the trial boards and who are engaged and involved with internal affairs. We have to create the kind of civilian review board that has teeth in working with the city. And we have to address what happened as a result of the Department of Justice.
Okay, Alan Walden, in light of the uprising in 2015 and then the subsequent trials in which there were no convictions obtained for any of the police officers indicted in that case, the DOJ, the Department of Justice, has issued a scathing report about the Baltimore Police Department. A consent decree is the next step. What should be in that consent decree?
I'm not sure, because I think we may be dealing with a flawed narrative to start with. And the flawed narrative is that the police are out to get black people, that there is a nationwide conspiracy of some kind, although the word conspiracy is not used. There's no question that the changes have to be made within the structure of the police department, that there have to be changes in tactics and changes in procedures to make the police department more user-friendly. Can we use that phrase? In other words, more easily connectable with the community, and the community, as a result, more connectable with the police. I met with Ray Kelly and the No Boundaries Coalition last week.
He's from the No Boundaries Coalition,
yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And they have a manifesto which makes a great deal of sense, except for one thing. They want to create a new structure and an enormous new bureaucratic board to oversee the actions of the police department. We don't need enormous new boards. What we need is something to replace the existing civilian review board, which doesn't have enough power to do what it actually should do. So I'm in favor of replacing it, but not with dozens and dozens of people and creating a new bureaucracy which will simply burden the police even more.
All right, Joshua Harris, young men of color like yourself perhaps have a very different lived experience on the streets of Baltimore than Mr. Walden is describing. What do you think?
Absolutely. I think that it's obvious that if you were young and black in Baltimore, you didn't need the Department of Justice report to come out to understand the realities that we exist in every single day. Also, if you were an elected official who was shocked by the Department of Justice report, you're part of the problem, because there have been checks that have been written administration after administration knowing that this has been an issue. And so when it comes to restructuring and reform, a lot of folks will say we need revolutionary political change. I'll say we need evolutionary change. We have to begin to evolve in our policies and our practices. This is the 21st century, and unfortunately, Baltimore isn't in it yet. And so when we talk about transitioning the city into the 21st century and 21st century leadership, I can't help but point out that all of my opponents are above the age of 60, and in any other industry, they would be retired. So when we talk about new ideas and a new vision to transition Baltimore into the 21st century, we have to begin to evolve in the policies and procedures that we put into place, because the things of the old and of the 20th century are no longer relevant and are no longer working. So we have to transition and make sure we're working to ensure that we have a better Baltimore tomorrow than what we have today. And that not just includes police department, but that includes all of our agencies.
What bothers me most about what you just said, Josh, is the ageism. I'm a member of the only ism that is allowed to be excoriated and no one complains. The assumption being, if you're older and you're part of the 20th century, and I was born in 1936, that somehow you've lost touch with reality. We haven't. We've kept up. We know what's going on.
But this is, even on the national stage, people are calling this a change election. I mean, the ascendancy of Mr. Trump is credited in many ways to the fact that people are looking for disruption and change. Now, it's a matter of discussion as to whether or not Ms. Dixon's election or Ms. Pugh's election would represent change. But still, there is this notion. What do you think about this, Sheila Dixon? Is this a change election? And what is the case that you make that you would be the candidate of change, given the fact that you've already held the office and you had to resign because of a conviction?
Well, first of all, let's talk about my track record as mayor. And let's talk about it took my administration, after several administrations, to really go through our police department. Let's just talk about crime, to begin to create the kind of environment where our police officers were going to be responsive and responsible to the community, where our communities were going to be able to feel safe no matter where you lived. And it was under that my administration that reduced crime across the board, because I just didn't look at police locking up people. It was the reverse. It was our police being engaged and involved, but also focus on, and this is the piece that where we talk about change and being a public servant, and I agree with Joshua, where we definitely need a evolution and a revolutionary change. But I'm talking about we have to begin to focus on systemic, and that's the difference in who I am and why people have been so responsive to me, because it's about systemic things that we now have faced generation after generation.
Great.
That politicians don't want to fix because it's something that's going to take time versus cutting ribbons for buildings that in some cases aren't going to change the people in the city. And that's where my focus has always been.
All right, we're going to go to some of those people in the city. Dwayne in Curtis Bay, you've been very patient. Welcome to Midday with Sheila Dixon, Alan Walden, and Joshua Harris.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind today?
Excellent.
And now, Dwayne, we can hear you, so I apologize. It looks like we had a little cell phone issue. Let's move to Jerry in Baltimore. Jerry, welcome to Midday. Hi, Jerry. How you doing? What's on your mind today, my man? Jerry, we can't understand what you're talking about. Sorry, we are running through a whole list of phone problems, and I apologize. Monroe, you are on Midday. Welcome to Midday, Monroe. Welcome to the show. We hope you can hear.
Thank you for taking that call.
Yes.
I'm just wondering, why does the electorate in Baltimore City always vote Democratic? And they say they vote because their mother and father did it, their great-grandmother, their great-grandfather did it. Their great's going on back forever. And when you get a Democrat in, which has controlled the city since, I guess, Adam and Eve, you get all the promises beforehand, and you get nothing once they're in office. That's for the mayor and the city council.
All right,
all
well,
they
Monroe,
do is
Thank you for your call. I appreciate the sentiment. Of course, people vote for a variety of reasons. Maybe they vote because of the way their parents and grandparents voted. There are 306,000 registered Democrats in the city of Baltimore, about 32,000 registered Republicans, and about 1,200 registered Green Party voters in the city of Baltimore. And of course, political parties represent values, don't they, Alan Walden? I mean, there are certain values that the Democrats espouse that are, you know, in complete contrast to the Republicans.
You'd like to believe that they represent values, but I'm not going to say that every Republican represents certain values or that every Democrat represents certain values. The thing is, in the city of Baltimore, we do not have what I would call a, quote, democracy. We have a plutocracy. It's a political plutocracy. The Democrats have had 100% of the members of the city council since Adolf Hitler came to power, and we haven't had a Republican mayor since Theodore Roosevelt McKeldin, and that was half a century ago. When you're in power for that long, one party, however good your intentions may be, you have a tendency to get lazy. You have a tendency to keep doing the same thing in the same way.
Well, but Josh
Harris, that's not always a good idea.
Josh Harris, what do you think about that contention? Because we have had a Democrat in the mayor's office for a long time, but they have been different Democrats. I mean, I think most people would say that Stephanie Rawlings Blake was a very different mayor than Sheila Dixon, who was a very different mayor than Martin O'Malley, who was a very different mayor than Kurt Schmoke, who was a very different mayor than Dew Burns, William Donald Schaefer. I mean, these are individuals who hold this office, even though they are aligned with a particular political party.
I think that it is it's problematic to have just one party in power for too long. They become complacent. But then when you look at, though we've had different mayors, when you look at what it comes back to and what my campaign has really been about addressing, economic justice, and you look at the economic distribution of capital or the city's resources, the majority, if not all of the policies, have been in favor of major corporations at the expense of people, at the expense of our neighborhoods, and at the expense of our schools, which are crumbling. When you look at the Port Covington decision most recently, $660 million is going to be given. We're going to miss out on at least $50 million in education funding because of this deal. And if you were shopping for a car, you wouldn't buy the car up front and then say, we'll work out the details of the contract after the fact. No, you want to make sure that you're looking at long-term sustainability. And when we're looking at development, we should look at that from a regional perspective. But yet, here we come. We have a billion-dollar company, and we trust and value everything that they say. So we're going to give them this money, and whatever they decide to give the community and the people is what we're going to go with and what we're going to decide to agree with, rather than having a community-minded center focus of development, which is what sustainability really looks like. Even when you look at the White House plan for development that they recently released, I'd say there's at least 10 things immediately that we have done that's the opposite of what is the most beneficial for sustainable community development when we look at how we've developed our city.
All right, we'll talk about Port Covington in a minute, but I want to go back to Dwayne in Curtis Bay. Dwayne, I'm feeling lucky today, so I'm going to give you a second chance. I hope the phone has improved. Can you hear us? Because we hope we can hear you. Dwayne from Curtis Bay, you with me, my brother?
Going once.
All right. Sorry, Dwayne. Two strikes and we're out. Sorry about that. We're going to go to Baltimore City. Dina is on the line in here on Midday. You're with Midday here with Sheila Dixon, Alan Walden, and Joshua Harris. Welcome to the show, Dina.
Thank you. Mrs. Dixon, I have a question for you. Because ever since you left office, Baltimore City streets and everything have gone a roar. I want to know, what difference are you going to make as far as the water bills, the gas and electric bills, and bringing back the incentive for people who have tickets who cannot afford to pay the tickets?
All right, Sheila Dixon, a question for you.
Well,
from
you know,
Dina.
I appreciate that question, and I also appreciate the fact that you noticed that I was really trying to have our agencies be responsive to our citizens of Baltimore. And we have to get back to that. People who go into public office, I don't care what the party is that you're a part of, we work for the citizens, and we've lost that sense of who you work for, the taxpayers. And so actually, let me just talk about quality of services. We have, you know, in our budget, we don't have a whole lot of money that people think we have. But you have to take what little you have, and you have to be able to be creative in how you do resurfacing in the street. As relates to the water bill, tomorrow I'm at a press conference, I'm going to talk about some things that have to happen. Before that water bill and the consent decree that we received back in 1999 when I was city council president and Martin O'Malley was mayor, when they said that you have to upgrade your system, but we're not giving you any money. And this is the federal government. But this is where we have to rely on certain levels of government to help. And the current mayor was the U.S. Conference of Mayors. She was the head of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. She saw the president all the time. You would think with that kind of power that you would have been lobbying for resources to come to the city. The city can't even to this day tell you what percentage has gotten accomplished of the consent decree. So before we start raising more water bills, we need to know. The citizens need to know. You know, where are we? Are we 10% done of the consent decree? 25%?
You're talking
done?
About the environmental consent decree. You're not talking about
I'm talking
the DOJ.
About, she's talking about the water bill.
Right.
And the water bill increases is the consent decree from the environment and upgrading our sewer and water system.
The EPA, the upgrade
EPA
that's been taking place over the
since
last.
Since 1999.
Right.
So where are we? So is our excuse to keep raising people's water bills and then still not getting it right by having a wireless system and people still being charged more than what they need? We gotta fix city government. Our agencies are in disastrous state, and we
Alan
gotta
Walden?
Fix that.
Well, this is one of the problems that I was addressing obliquely a few minutes ago. We waited too long to deal with this issue. We have an aging infrastructure. We have a 300-year-old city. We know that the infrastructure, which translates into the problem with water, has been aging and decaying for years, and really nothing was done. So we're now faced with
Moving forward with all those terracotta pipes sitting under the streets,
we've got
how do we fix them? Where are the resources come to fix them?
Well, Sheila brought up the point of the federal government assisting, and it can, but we've waited so long to do this. Where were the other administrations prior to this? Why wasn't this addressed more directly much earlier than now when we are burdened by much higher water bills?
You have to Josh
Harris. Let's give Mr. Harris the mic.
I think that it's important that we unpack this. We talk about that the resources aren't there, and the city hall does have a limited budget, which is why I think that it's extremely important that we look at policy solutions and changes, which is what my platform, Banking for Baltimore Undivided, presents. The policy staple of it is public banking, which really gives us the ability to take control of our economic future, to leverage the budget that we have and create the wealth necessary to make these improvements, knowing that right now our $2.7 billion budget is sitting in the bank on Wall Street, and that bank is doing what banks do, getting rich off of other people's money, our money in this case. And all the increases we see in water bills, in property taxes, fees and fines, cuts to education, cuts to parks and rec, all come back to pay off the debt that the city has incurred. If we can eliminate that debt and remove ourselves from that debt, we can have tremendous fiscal impact to our future generations and the next administration, knowing that if we simply took our $2.7 billion out of that Wall Street bank and opened up our own Baltimore City Public Bank, we can leverage it the exact same way that they do on Wall Street. But now every penny of interest earned comes back to the citizens of Baltimore. So instead of some rich guy's pocket on Wall Street, it would be coming back to your parks and recs, back to your schools, and so many other things that we can do great things with by taking control of our economic future.
We got to take a break. Joshua Harris is the Green Party nominee for the mayor of the city of Baltimore. Alan Walden, the Republican nominee. Former Mayor Sheila Dixon is a Democrat, and she is a write-in candidate in the election. Early voting starts Thursday. The election is Tuesday, November 8th. That's 2 weeks from today. We would love to hear from you and have you be part of our conversation here on Midday. 410-662-8780. You can drop us a tweet at Midday Tom Hall or send us an email, midday@wypr.org. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Stick around. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guests today are mayoral candidates Sheila Dixon, Alan Walden, and Joshua Harris. Senator Catherine Pugh, the winner of the Democratic primary for mayor and the person heavily favored to win in the general election on November 8th, accepted our invitation to join us last month until last weekend when she decided not to be part of this conversation for reasons she was not able to explain. You can, however, be part of this conversation. If you'd like, you can give us a call at 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. I want to go right back to the phones. Donnie from Sandtown, welcome to Midday with Sheila Dixon, Alan Walden, and Joshua Harris.
Thank you for having me. Madam Mayor, how do we make Baltimore more business friendly? We're chasing businesses, especially downtown. It's god awful. I mean, from parking to, it's just crazy. We're chasing businesses out of Baltimore. Thank you.
Well, first of all, currently this tax structure that we are dealing with so many permits and fees that we put on businesses, we really need to do a overall assessment of what we currently have, how we can operate, and we need to rescind some of these permit fees. Let me give you an example. When I was mayor, the permit fee to have outdoor seating, which is very popular in many communities, I don't remember the dollar amount, but the current administration tripled those fees. There was
this for like restaurants and stuff.
Yeah, for restaurants and little coffee shops who want to have outdoor seatings, because when you have people out on the street, it makes people feel safe. And also it attracts people. So we have to look at those fees. We need to rescind some of those fees. I mean, let's look at the container tax. Believe me, when we have to address deficits in city government, you know, we quickly want to raise the bottle tax. We want to put in other taxes. We've got to stop taxing people out of the city. That's why Baltimore County.
Are there revenue sources that you think would be much preferable to things like a container tax or permit fees?
Well, what I think we have to do is we need to, and this is something, and the document is there. It was researched. We have it all listed. It was called the Blue Book that we created, which is probably on the shelf right now, where we were assessing all these different fees and taxes. And we're saying to ourselves, how can we do better with less, as well as how can we help taxpayers, businesses, and citizens who want to live here, stay here? And what do we need to do differently as far as the services that we render to our constituents?
Alan Walden.
You have to revitalize the communities in order to attract more people and attract more small business. That means you have to streamline the permit process, no question about that. And the fees are a little crazy. But you also have to improve things like mass transit. The west part of Baltimore, West Baltimore, could benefit greatly from an increase in mass transit, an improvement of mass transit, meaning a light rail line, good old trolley car line along North Avenue. Maybe from security.
And you think that's
all
possible, given the fact that the Republican governor, Larry Hogan, got rid of the red line proposal?
The Republican governor got rid of the red line, which I described as a good idea gone bad, because part of the red line would mean digging holes through a very important part of a city. It would take a long time to do it, whereas surface mass transit, light rail, is much easier to build, easier to maintain, highly visible, and it generates interest. It generates the idea of movement and progress. And I think that kind of development, that light rail line along North Avenue, with its marvelous architecture and its vacant buildings, would have a great deal to do with renovating the city.
All right, we just have a few minutes left here on the program. I want to make sure we get to as many calls as possible. Gary from Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Glad you're with us.
Thank you very much for having me. I just wanted to make a comment and maybe a question. I really like the idea that Mr. Harris put forth about keeping Baltimore City tax dollars in the city, investing in our community, as opposed to investing it into these big banks where we're getting Wall Street and different bankers, you know, making money off of our tax money and keeping it here and investing it in our cities. And when I heard that and I thought about it, that why isn't this something that the Democratic Republic parties would put forth, I think, about corporate sponsorship, and they're making money off of these donors and don't necessarily have the interest of Baltimore City residents at heart. And I'm curious to know what the Republican Democratic candidates think about Mr. Harris' idea and what their thoughts are on keeping that money in the city,
right,
allowing
Gary?
Us to make money off of it and use it for public funding.
Thanks for your call, Gary. And by the way, before we go to the other two candidates, Josh Harris, is this idea of a public bank been tried in other places?
Yes. North Dakota has a public bank. They've avoided every stock market crash in the last 100 years because of that. And most recently, they were able to cut student loan interest rates in half for all students that had loans through the North Dakota Public Bank. Because when you look at a 2% versus a 4% interest rate and you're going to educate your constituents, it's a win-win all the way around because the interest is coming right back into the state in their case.
Sheila Dixon, you called for a land bank during the primary campaign. What's the difference between a land bank and a public bank for the green stuff?
Actually, and to the listening audience, we were talking offline that it's an excellent idea that Joshua is talking about, and it's a good way. We couldn't take all of our money out because of the rating that we have to be based on with our bonding, but it's a great way to pilot an initiative. And on that note, a land bank could go hand in hand. We don't have a lot of cash, but we have a lot of vacant properties and we have a lot of land. And by creating a land bank, we can leverage that. So if an individual wants to develop a house or a developer, small or large, wants to come into a community and help to revise it, we make that as our investment and then they leverage that. Because that's the one thing right now that we have a lot of. But we would have to clear away the tax liens and all of that, and that would be our contribution to a project in a community like Sandtown, like the community that we're currently in, or like in Cherry Hill. I mean, this between a land bank and a land trust, I understand, is on the ballot in this upcoming election, is a great way to leverage that.
We got a long list of folks waiting to join the conversation. This is an email from Dave in Baltimore who asks, what would the candidates do to offer low-income or affordable housing to reduce or eliminate people living and dying on our streets? How would they reduce or eliminate offensive and illegal behavior by employees in the housing administration?
There is a way to deal with this if we make housing more available, and that is offer the houses that require rehabilitation at very low rates to the people who want to become homeowners. Make it easier for them to do it. Say to the people who want to be homeowners, become homeowners and live in the city, give us $500, here's the house. Now, here's the deal. You have to live in it for 5 years. You have to rehabilitate it. You can't flip it. This is not for slumlords. This is yours, and you have to contribute to the community by doing this. We can do something like that.
And in the Schaefer administration, it was $1 a house. You're suggesting $500.
$1 a house.
It's the same idea?
It's basically the same idea. Speaking of the same ideas, this is one case where the representatives or the nominees of different parties and different philosophies do not always disagree. Josh's idea about a public bank has great merit. The idea of a land bank has great merit. But you got to remember that Baltimore is not North Dakota, which is booming right now, whereas Baltimore is not.
There's a little bit of oil that they found in North Dakota, too.
And I think, too, I want to address it. The question that they had was, why haven't we heard these ideas from Dems or Republicans? This is progressive policy solutions. And traditionally what we see is that individuals from the traditional parties, they get in office and they do what is the status quo in most cases. And so as someone who's not, I'm always looking for new innovative ideas and approaches that we can bring that can work here.
Let's go back to the phones. Let me interrupt you for a second because we just have about 5 minutes left. And I want to make sure we get to a few more callers. Phil in North Baltimore, thanks for being on Midday.
Good afternoon. Mr. Walden?
Yes.
Pleasure to talk to you. I will vote for you, but I would like to know also what you would do about trying to fight crime more than recent administrations have done.
How to fight crime, the best way to fight crime is to get the public and the police department to cooperate more than they have cooperated until now. We have to change attitudes, not only in the police, but in the public in general. Go back to the days of Parron Mitchell. Parron Mitchell said, us killing us is genocide. This is back in the 1970s. Or even Kurt Schmoke, who asked the public to cooperate with the police department, and mostly it fell on deaf ears. We have to get that cooperation back to where it was. And at the same time, we have to understand that the circumstance that now exists, which marginalizes the police department to a large degree, has created the uptick in crime rather than reduced it.
Josh Harris, there's a so many different parameters to the inequality that exists in the city: racial mm-hmm. inequality, economic inequality, access to health care, access to food and healthy things to eat. How do you address the racial and economic divides that are clearly present in our city?
Well, that's clearly a focus of mine. My platform is called Banking for Baltimore Undivided. And knowing that those are issues that really need to address, and one of the reasons I decided to run as a Green is because the Green Party is a party that has been actively in the fight for social justice, racial justice, economic justice, and environmental justice. And so for me, so many of it comes back to understanding economics, knowing that before a young black man is killed in his own neighborhood, either by his peer or by the police, 90% of the time in Baltimore City, he went to a school where he couldn't drink the water, where it didn't have heat or air heat in the wintertime or air conditioning in the summertime. In most cases, that was because that money was going to a billion-dollar company, whether it be for a Harbor Point TIF or for a Port Covington TIF. And so it led the officers or the individual who was in that community that slayed him to believe that he was devalued, that he didn't have worth. And so understanding how economic justice and investing economically in these communities that have been void and neglected for too long, how that can begin to address and bring some equity to how we see things being done in our city. And it's also a jobs plan when we talk about crimes.
All right, Michelle, you're going to have the last word. You're calling from Towson. Welcome to Midday.
Hi, my name is Michelle Espineen. I'm a resident of the county, and I would like to move to the city, but as I'm listening to everyone, I want to understand, like, why does every politician always run on this platform that we're going to get rid of taxes or we're not going to raise them when taxes actually serve a purpose? They're to go to the city to fix all the disrepair. So how about you take the taxes that you currently have and apply them appropriately instead of only funneling the money down to the harbor or in Canton or in certain areas? Because I would love to move to the city, but I don't see the responsibility there when it comes to applying the money appropriately.
Sheila Dixon, make the pitch to Michelle.
I agree wholeheartedly that you do. If you're going to raise the taxes, you need to apply it appropriately. And actually, the water increases that have been happening over the years are going to the upgrades of the system, but it's also about overtaxing people to be able to solve problems instead of addressing the problems head on. And that's why so many residents in Baltimore City have fled to Baltimore County and other parts of the state because of high car insurance, the property tax, and other taxes that tend to affect us.
Yeah,
and
tax is certainly a big issue.
There's
on
a balance
lot of people's
in mind.
That. And Alan Walling, I'm going to give you the last word. We have 10 seconds.
The property tax is too high. Double what it is anywhere else in any other jurisdiction. It has to be cut, not in 10 years, now.
Alan Walden is the Republican nominee for mayor. Joshua Harris is the Green Party nominee for mayor. Sheila Dixon is the former mayor of Baltimore and a write-in candidate for that office this time around. We've got links to more information on our website, wypr.org/midday. And remember, early voting begins on Thursday, and the election is 2 weeks from today. Thank you all for being here. I appreciate
it.
Thank you for having us.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk with Republican candidate for Congress, Dr. Mark Plaster. He's trying to unseat Democratic incumbent John Sarbanes in Maryland's 3rd Congressional District. And coming up on Friday here on Midday, a conversation with incumbent Democratic Congressman Dutch Ruppersberger and Delegate Pat McDonough, who is challenging Representative Ruppersberger in Maryland's 2nd Congressional District. So lots of politics coming up this week here on Midday. Lunch for our guest today has been provided by Joe Squared. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. One more programming note. Tonight at 9 o'clock here on 88.1 WYPR, it's Choral Arts Classics. The musicologist Ray Sprenkel is my guest. We'll talk about and listen to a beautiful piece by the French composer Maurice Duroflay, his setting of the Requiem. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for spending part of your day with us here at Midday. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR. Here and Now is coming up next with an update on some of the day's top news, plus more perspectives on the presidential race from Colorado. Then at 3:00